Hello, and welcome to the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative to record America's family history in sound. Oral histories are one of the most personal and rewarding ways to preserve family stories. The Tell Me a Story sessions are 45-minute interviews between two people with the assistance of a trained facilitator. Participants will receive a compact disc with the full interview. A copy will be archived at the Midwest Genealogy Center and, with permission, later made available to the public. And now, another story.
This is Saturday, September 10, 2016. This is Tony Herman interviewing Charles Bradbury and his wife Janet about Charles's experience in the military. Charles, did you grow up in this area?
Yes, sir. Grew up in Raytown.
Okay, and when did you join the service?
They joined me February 19th, 1969.
So, drafted?
Drafted.
How old were you at the time?
About 18, 19. 69. I was 20.
Okay. Okay. And did you serve in the war?
Yes, I spent my time in Vietnam. From like November of 69 to February of 71.
In the Army?
In the Army.
Okay. What unit were you with?
I was with the 164th Combat Aviation Group in Can Tho, South Vietnam.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about it, your experiences there.
What did you do?
Well, I was a door gunner in a Huey, but the experience when I first got into country is when we sat down and they opened the plane door and the humidity hit you right in the face, and then the stink. It just almost knocked you to your knees because it was so stinky, dirty air, you know. And I said, oh, I need to go back home to Raytown right now.
What type of odor was it?
They burnt their sewage. It was just sewer stuff.
Okay.
Unbelievable smell.
And you were a tail gunner on a helicopter?
I was a door gunner on a
door gunner.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what type of helicopter was
it? It was a Huey, B model Huey.
And what type of missions did those helicopters have?
We did everything you can think of. Our busiest part is when we first invaded Cambodia. It was pretty much a nonstop for several days. Then we finished that up. We got out of Cambodia. Then we went and invaded Laos. So that was another busy, taking troops in, taking troops out, checking supplies up. You just did a little bit of everything. Whatever needed to be done at that particular time, you did it.
Okay. How long were you in Vietnam?
What, 13 months?
I thought it was 1 year, 11 months, and one day.
No, that's how long I spent in the Army.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I had about 13 months.
Okay. What was the highest rank you achieved?
Spec 5.
Okay. Any incidents that you recall that were out of the ordinary?
Well, we had a lot of out of the ordinary. We was coming back, I think it was December 1970, taking troops up to the Bob Hope USO show. We got shot down coming back. That was interesting. When we invaded Cambodia, that was really intense. That was just really intense. I mean, mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine unless you experience it. You're the biggest target in the air, and you're down on the ground, and you're letting troops out or picking troops up, and they're shooting at you because you're easy to see. Another experience we had is one evening we were slinging a 10kW generator out to a radar site, and we picked up Communist China fire. It was like a 51 caliber. I've never seen 51 caliber. It looked like a ball bat. And we quickly ejected the 10kW generator and got out of there. That was close.
Now, when you were taking troops to the Bob Hope show, did you get to stay and watch the show?
No.
No?
No. By the time we got done, troops taking back and forth, you know, it's just pretty cool, take a nap.
Okay.
Yeah, I was tired.
What about when you were at the radar site?
Oh, there's one time at Seven Sisters Mountains we used at a radar site. I originally was a mechanic and got drafted in as a gunner. They had some generators that were down, and so I said, well, I'll see if I can't fix it. So they dropped me off to see if I can't get their generators up and going for ground units, because this is just right before we hit was invading Cambodia, and got a couple of them going. The rest of them, we got invaded that night, and there's like 13 of us. We was on top of a hill, and there's hundreds of those little guys down below, and we fought all night long. And daylight came, we couldn't get support, so daylight came, and I remember Captain Tippett sent a helicopter up after us, and he figured that we'd all be dead, but none of us were hurt. When we stepped out of this little bunker, all you did is step on brass. And why they didn't come around and flank us, I have no idea. None. So we were pretty well really dirty with gunpowder, you know, just a mess. And we were so thankful to get out of there in one piece. That was it. That was a night to remember.
I would imagine.
That was June 13, 1970.
Did you have any interactions with the South Vietnamese civilians?
Yeah.
How did they, respect the soldiers?
Those people, I mean, a lot of people, those poor people didn't know what to do. So during the daytime, you know, they worked, helped us. They worked on our post, you know, and did laundry and cleaning and cooking and whatever. And then at nighttime, they had to probably do something for the Vietnamese, or North Vietnamese, in order to stay alive. So they was kind of caught in a box. You know, we'll help them, and we'll help them, but, you know, they really didn't know, you know, what to do. I don't think they liked us because we paid them money, but on the other hand, they wanted to keep their families alive, so they had to help the MBA to keep alive. So, you know, it was really a, you know, difficult time for them. They didn't, you know, it's a catch 22. You either do or you don't. So, yeah, they were, you know, the very poor country. You know, they just lived in paper shacks or cardboard shacks, and every day was just survival mode for them to keep alive, and they could work on our compound. And, you know, the government gave them money. I gave Mama Son $5 a month or so, and she made my bed and did my laundry and swept up the hooch area, you know. And so that way, you know, they had some money to buy some food and groceries with and stuff like that. But I can't really feel bad for her because they didn't know which side to, you know. The Americans here were going to help you, give you money, and the North Vietnamese were, you know, if you didn't do this, we're going to wipe out your family. So, you know, I feel bad for the people. And they were really good people. I mean, you know, they're just trying to live.
Okay. What was your camp like?
Our camp was, we were 2 foot below sea level. And every time it rained, we had water up to about mid-calf. In our hooch, I stayed upstairs, and the ones, there was two stories, and the ones that on the bottom floor usually had about a foot of water or so in the bottom floor of their hooch when it was monsoons come. So it was it wasn't very comfortable living. No air conditioning. They just old wooden barrack hooches with screens and a tin roof and plywood floor and lockers for your divider, and that was about it.
But that was more or less your permanent camp?
That was my permanent camp. And, yes, that was not the best, but it wasn't the worst, and you make the best of what you got.
So what was it like coming home?
Coming home was a totally different story. I was very disappointed when I came into Fort Ord, California, an ETS out of there. A bunch of us got in a cab, and nobody knew each, you know. When we went over, it's just one person, which is me, in the same way a lot of us getting out of the Army. There's like six of us got in a cab, and we went up to San Francisco International Airport. I was going to get me a ticket home, TWA, and there's all these people dressed in hippie stuff, and when we walked in to the terminal there, and went up to the TWA ticket counter, well, these people, there's a big line, that just kind of split like Moses split at the Red Sea. And I thought to myself, well, how nice are these people going to let us go up there and get our tickets to go home? Well, that wasn't the story. They split so they could spit at us, call us baby killers, throw stuff at us, all kinds of names. But anyway, the six of us, since that line was split, we still went ahead and got our tickets. And we got out of there because I'm afraid there would have probably been trouble if they kept up, because all of us that was coming in there were all out of Vietnam. And we didn't appreciate the way they treated us because most of us in Vietnam were drafted. We didn't want anything to do with it, but that was our duty. They called on us to do our duty for our country, and we did that, and we didn't want to go to Canada or whatever and be a deserter or whatever. So, and I didn't appreciate that. But that was my duty.
You had even another incident after you got into Kansas City.
Oh yes, I did. I brought back Cambodia. I brought back a communist made China rifle. It's a war cellar here. And so when I was getting short, you know, I went. This rifle went through more checks and balances than from Vietnam to Nakoda, Japan, through Oakland, California, through San Francisco, through Denver, because I had a layover there. And then when I got into Kansas City, it was the old airport downtown. This was in February of 71. My brother, my dad, and grandma, you know, we were there. And my B-4 bag came down, and my brother grabbed it. And I said, wait a minute, I'm waiting for something else. So my rifle came down. It was all wrapped up. And we were heading out, and there was this little private guy, which is a security patrol back then, hollered at me and said, hey, troop. And I looked at him, and I go, who are you calling that troop? You. And I go, I'm not a troop there, private. And anyway, he said, I'm going to have to confiscate your weapon. I said, you what? I'm going to have to take your weapon from you. And I said, I don't think you're big enough. And about that time, here come a regular MP sergeant, and I remember his name was Johnson, nice guy. He said, Private, what seems to be the problem? He says, I got to take this weapon. And the sergeant looked at him and says, son, do you see how red he is? And I go, yeah. He says, you're about to get an ass whipping in your life right now. And so we cleared that up, you know. And on the walking way out to get the car with my dad, he says, I just knew I was going to have to bail you out of jail because he's ready to plow him. And we went on home. And there was a lot of changes in Kansas City at that time. 435 was finishing up. Blue Ridge Boulevard was now four lanes. What else? It was just that short period of time period, there was a lot of changes in Kansas City, you know? They was building the sports complex. You know, that was, wow, look at that. And they was working on KCI. They got to leave. And, you know, I went home and stayed there at home for a couple, 3 days. had my apartment back in Leaf Summit, went to work the next Monday, and that was it.
Well, that wasn't exactly it.
Okay.
Because when he came back from Vietnam, and I met Chuck in July of 1974, and so he had been back a little over 3 years. He had a very short temper.
I may see your mom.
He had a hard time keeping a job for a long period of time. He worked very hard, but he was non-communicative, and he had nightmares. He had really bad nightmares that he did not ever remember what they were, but he would make the most awful groaning and crying out and flailing to the point that I would have to get up and go sleep on the sofa. He was very jumpy. If you tried to wake him up, it could be dangerous. He refused to eat rice for about 30 years. It wasn't until 2010 that a friend of mine who works for the National VFW came to visit me in the hospital and asked Chuck if he had signed up for his benefits, and he had not. So she insisted that he do so and also join a VFW post. And it was after he signed up for his benefits that he was diagnosed with PTSD, and we began counseling and medications, and the war was finally over for me, because I felt mm-hmm. like I fought it every night with him, because he had these nightmares almost every night. Through that and Project Healing Waters, which is a fly fishing organization for veterans, that has done a lot for the nightmares are at bay. He has them once in a while, but nothing like what we went through for 40 years. He's calmer. He's more open. He didn't talk about his war experience until about 10 years ago, ever. He would say a snippet here and a snippet there, but it was just something that wasn't discussed.
But it really does help to discuss it, because you can get it off your mind.
Yeah.
Get it out of there.
Unfortunately, it takes a long time for a lot of people to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have any physical injuries while you were in Vietnam?
Nah, not really.
Okay. Any medals?
Oh, yes. Our Congressman Sam Graves, was it 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
I was at a town hall meeting with him, and afterwards I said, you know, I've really never received anything from Vietnam. So I got with one of his interns and gave him the information, and 6 weeks later I get a call from this lady at his office, and she says, well, we have your medals, Mr. Bradbury. And I go, really? What have I got? She said, well, you got 9 of them. And I go, 9 medals? And I go, well, you can mail them to me. She says, no, Congressman Gray is going to have a ceremony for you in April. What was it? 2014 at the American Legion's Post 499 in Blue Springs. And I said, oh, that's not necessary. She says, yeah, it is. And I said, that's right, it's election year. and sure enough, he was there and had all my medals, and then the Kansas City Star was there, and there's a few TV stations there. And presented me with all the medals and my 3 stars for different campaigns, and President Citation Medal and the Air Medal and Good Conduct Medal, and I don't remember them all. But it was a nice. It was. Yeah. I was overwhelmed with that, because I had no idea that I had anything like that coming.
You still have contact with anybody that was in any of your units?
I do. I flew with the first lieutenant, his name when I first met him, it was Robert Tippett, and I was his door gunner. And then he was promoted to captain, and I really admired this man. He was a super guy, just a super. And for about 4 years or so, Jan had been looking for him, and she found him, and he lived in Shell Knob, Missouri. And so that was during February, 2 years ago? We was working a sports show with Project Healy Waters, and we happened to walk out, and she stopped by the booth at Shell Knob. And Jan asked her, says, "Well, you tell the story."
Well, I said, "Do you have a map?" And they said, "Yes, are you planning on visiting soon?" And I said, "Well, I hope so, because I have found my husband's captain that he flew with in Vietnam." And they said, "Oh, what's his name?" And I said, "Robert Tippett." And they said, "Bob Tippett?" And I said, "Well, I imagine so." And the lady happened to be the cashier at the grocery store, so she knew everyone. And she said, "Well, honey, they moved." And my face must have just fallen, because I said, "Oh, no." And I said, "I've looked for years for him, because my husband really admired him and spoke so highly of him." And she said, "Well, just a minute. She got on her cell phone, and she made some calls and wrote down some stuff. And she said, "Here," she says, "I've got his address." They had moved to North Carolina. "I've got his address, I've got his email, his wife's email, and their phone number." So I was just elated. So didn't say anything to Chuck, and we go home, and I finally tell him, "I have found Captain Tippett, and he's moved to North Carolina, and here's his phone number, and I think you should call him." And you
did.
And
I did.
And you talked.
And he was in Costco. In Charlotte. And we talked probably for an hour. And I said, "You probably don't remember me, but my name is Chuck Bradbury." And he goes, "Ah, you go by the nickname of Brad." He remembered that after 45 years. And he said, "Yeah." And so we talked and talked and talked and talked. And then that next April, we met up down at Branson, Missouri. And he was down there for a
Coast Guard
auxiliary deal, because he's still active in that stuff. And we sat there in the hotel and talked for hours. And then we went over to the fish house on the lake there and had dinner. And we talked for another hours.
They would have sat on each other's laps if they could. I mean, they were so close. I mean, they were just overjoyed. And Chuck was the first one from the 164th who had contacted Captain Tippett, who was now a colonel by then. But he and his wife were just absolutely lovely. And it really meant a lot to Colonel Tippett that Chuck had gone to the trouble and remembered him so kindly.
Oh, I really liked the guy.
Chuck always said that he was very smart, and that he kept them out of trouble a million times, where some pilots would just go in and and he would keep them safe, get the job done, but keep them safe.
Good. Yes. Do you have any regrets about your service?
No, not really. No, it was a time where most of us young people really grew up. As I say, I grew up in Raytown. My dad was an electrician. My mother was a housewife. Our neighborhood kids, we all played baseball, football, Boy Scouts together, you know, and then you get plucked from that environment over to a totally different environment was just quite a change. And then that really made you realize how fortunate we were to live in the United States with the freedoms that we do have. And they gave you a different perspective in life when you got back here, because you see a lot of ungrateful people. And I said, "Yeah, you need to go to Vietnam for a while and see how those people survive." Mm-hmm. You know, there's no telephones, there's a few occasional TVs, and you got Vietnamese radio, but you don't know what they're saying. And then they had an armed forces radio up there where they kind of kept you what's going on over in the United States. But you guys need to go there. Be grateful for what a great country this really is, because Vietnam is not a great country, and neither is Cambodia or Laos.
Besides the Healing Waters, what other veterans groups do you belong to?
I belong to American Legion's Post 21, AMBIT Post 181, our VFW Post. That's 30. About it.
VFW Post 30.
VFW Post 30.
Okay. Is there any other stories or anything you'd like to share?
No, that's pretty much covers everything. Okay.
I wish, I look in every Veterans Magazine organization thing that we get, there has never been any attempt by anyone to have a reunion for the 164th Combat Aviation Group. It was a very specialized group. It was created for a specific purpose, and it only lasted until 1974 or 75. Mm-hmm. And it was...
Oh, they disbanded in 73.
73.
67 to 73.
He had some people there that he talks about that I can't even begin to find nicely, and some of the others. I think it would be nice at this point in their lives if they could get together.
Sounds like that could be a project for you.
Well, I work on it every now and then. I also do genealogy, so I got a lot of projects going. But at this point in our lives, Chuck is 68 and I'm 64. He's calm enough that we really enjoy being retired. We've always kind of liked each other, so we enjoy being together. Mm-hmm. He's my best friend.
Yeah, she's my cellmate.
So I appreciate everything that everyone's done over time. I remember talking to my dad about Chuck. My dad was a World War II veteran, Battle of the Bulge and on. But he patted me on the shoulder and said, "Honey, he's shell-shocked." Well, I had no idea what that meant.
Was that July?
I thought it was, a physical thing from the concussion of a shell going off near you.
Yeah.
The first time we were together on the 4th of July, which was 1974, we were at my mother's house at Lake Lotawanna watching the big fireworks display at the yacht club, and we were both laying on a lounge chair and just enjoying it. And one of those big booming mortars went off, and before I could even blink, we were tipped over. He was laying over me, spread out. He was breathing really hard, and I mean, his eyes were just huge, and I was like, what just happened here? And that's when I had talked to my dad, but my dad never explained anything to me. So it wasn't until PTSD was really beginning to be put out into the public awareness that I was like, And so I talked to him about it, and of course, there's nothing wrong with me, he would say. There's nothing wrong with me. And he was really surprised when he got the diagnosis. And I mean, they didn't dilly-dally. They asked him a few questions and sent him right on into therapy. And it really did.
Mm-hmm.
Really did.
It helped.
It really helped a lot. And anything that helps him, of course. Helps me.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm so grateful to the VA and also to Project Healing Waters.
That's been Project Healing Waters has really, really been a wonderful organization for me to belong to. We're all different combat veterans from all different types of wars. We all get along, and we all know, even if I wasn't in Iraq or Afghanistan, but we know combat's combat no matter what country you're in or what continent you're on. Combat's combat. And we all bonded, and we all get along great.
They support each other.
We support each other. If February is a bad month for me. My best friend got killed in Vietnam. My brother got killed in February. So I've got a support group that I can call. Another great friend of mine, December is bad for him. And he was in Iraq. And so he needs me or whatever. And I know it's a bad month for him, so I'll call him and make sure that everything's okay. And he has called me a lot this last year, you know, because that was a bad time in his life. And so we support each other that way.
And this is through fly fishing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something outdoors and relaxing.
Oh, yeah, I love the outdoors.
Okay. Yeah. Well, in closing, what wisdom would you like to share with future generations?
I would like to see our future generations be more supportive of our country and our troops or our military personnel, because without them, we're in deep trouble. I mean, there a lot of people complain about all the wars going on, but we have to have armed forces. If not, we'd be overrun, or they would try to overrun. I don't think they could, because there's too many people out there that have combat experience that live at home. But yeah, it's just more respect. I mean, there's people that, you know, when we first went over to Iraq, you know, I wish they'd hurry up and get over this war, you know, stuff like that. And you go, well, it's better for us to be over there than them over here, you know. Well, I don't want my son to get in that. And I go, well, your son's no better than me, and I was drafted. So, you know, it's just respect us, you know. So, now, you know, I didn't want to go, but it was my duty, and I went. And just the way it should be. So.
All righty. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I'm good.
Okay. He's my hero.
Oh, you're my rock.
And on that positive note, we thank you for sharing your story with us, and thank you for your service.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it very much.
You're certainly welcome.